It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's one of those dishes everybody thinks they know. Curry, as in Indian curry. Now, what most of us don't know is how India's caste system and Britain's lust for empire turned curry global. Indian food expert Madhur Jaffrey has the tale. Michael Stern takes on the politics of the waffle at the Blue Plate Cafe in Memphis. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks the wild men of German wine labeling. Then it's the noodle of challenge and worship. Anya von Bremsen tells of the true soba noodles of Japan. We have a watermelon queen in love with petrochemicals and vocation vacations. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the backstory of India's most famous dish, curry, and how it circled the planet. Our guest, Indian Food Authority Madhur Jaffrey, says curry is the story of a caste system and Britain's old obsession with an empire where the sun never set. Well, wine expert Josh Wesson talks Germany's obsessive-compulsive wine labels and the renegades who are changing them. Then we hear about Japan's trickiest noodle. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Hey, Lynn. Michael finally found a place that serves the correct style of waffle. And this is no small deal.
What is the correct style of waffle, Michael?
The correct style of waffle is a thin, small tread waffle. Now, I have nothing against a Belgian waffle.
Oh, right. You have nothing against
it. I have nothing against a Belgian waffle in Belgium. And I hear from people who have eaten them there that they're very, very good. I've even seen pictures of them, and they look good. However, there is a plague of those big, cloddish, thick Belgian waffles all over this country to the degree that it's very rare to find a nice, thin, crisp, small tread waffle that to me is the way an American waffle ought to be.
Well, you know, the Belgian waffle started at the New York World's Fair in 64 in the Belgian Pavilion. And this was, you know, all the rage. You'd get a waffle with a big hunk of ice cream on it. But Belgian waffles have they're like the, you know, the movie The Blob. They just have sort of taken over everything in their path.
And restaurants are proud of serving these big, ugly things, when in fact, the fine thing to serve, as is served at the Blue Plate Cafe in Memphis, Tennessee.
On Poplar Avenue,
is a nice, thin waffle. Forget putting ice cream on it. That's ridiculous. One of the great things about one of those thin waffles with the small treads is that when you spread it with butter, each one of those little tiny squares can hold enough butter and syrup so that every forkful is a perfect combination of waffle, butter, and syrup, and is still a little bit crisp the way you want a waffle to be.
I really love this place also because it's in a private home, or I think it
used to. What was once a private home.
you don't go into somebody's private home. But it's got that very homey feel to it. And it's a cute little place, very cheery. And they have a classic meat and three lunch. Do you know that term?
Well, I think you should explain what that means.
Yeah.
What it means is that there's a list of maybe 3 to 5 entrees and then a list of a dozen to 2 dozen vegetables. And meat and three means you pick one entree and then 3 vegetables from the vegetable list, or as many people do, because these are really good Southern style vegetables. Forget the meat altogether and get a 4-vegetable plate of all the vegetables.
I love being vegan in the South.
Yes. As long as you don't mind all the ham hocks that all the vegetables are cooked with, it's great.
So they do the waffles, but what are the vegetables? And what kinds of things are they? Other things are they doing?
Well, fried okra.
Fried okra. One of my favorite vegetables is macaroni and cheese.
One of my favorite vegetables is Jell-O, which in the South they called congealed salad.
And then, of course, who could not love creamed corn for a vegetable?
Or fried corn.
But also there
are collards.
Or collard greens. There are really the turnip greens here are some of the best I've ever had. They're real, I don't know how to put, they're like just heavy, sort of thick and heavy and just sopped with that wonderful pot liquor juice that does have a real, you know, piggy, hammy flavor from being cooked so long. Mm-hmm. And you sprinkle a little of that vinegar peppers on those, and it's really a great side dish.
And in the South, they call what we just call peas. They call them English peas.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Field peas. They also have black-eyed peas. Just, you know, really good vegetables.
And actually, one of my favorite items on the menu, since we were discussing healthful food here, is that they have a sandwich that is made on whole wheat bread, and we all know that's healthful. What it is, though, is the Elvis favorite, fried peanut butter and banana on whole wheat bread.
Well, you're getting
and
your
I don't know if they fry it in bacon grease the way they're supposed to, because we haven't actually tried it.
But it is whole wheat bread.
It is whole wheat bread.
Well, I'm glad to see that you found the complex carbs, and Michael, that finally you found the waffle of your dreams. Thank you, guys.
Ah, yes. Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you.
Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Those stewed greens the Stearns were talking about really got me going, especially at this time of year. We get so preoccupied with all the flashy veggies, you know, the corn, the tomatoes, the chilies. But greens are prime right now. And the kinds out there have changed dramatically. I mean, I remember when you couldn't find a beet green anywhere. Now, beet leaves are part of this whole idea of using the tops of plants, which give us something else, like turnip greens or pea tops. Now, I'm convinced that my Tuscan relatives grow beets just for the greens. They taste mild and they're kind of sweet. And you cook them just the way you do spinach. You know, wilt them in hot water or saute them. Now, one family classic is mixing those wilted beet leaves with onion, ricotta, and parmesan. Now, you layer the blend between lasagna noodles and then you douse everything with fresh tomato sauce. You bake it off and you eat the summer lasagna hot or at room temperature. Now, in Austin, Texas last week, I found another dynamite idea for beet greens. The barbecue place we went for dinner did this new take on cream spinach. They mix cooked spinach with cream cheese and serrano chilies. Now, personally, I'd add a little garlic. Now, if you do this with beet greens and you serve it up with some barbecue, I guarantee there will be a stampede to get to those babies. Joshua Wesson is my kind of wine expert. He's a sommelier turned bargain hunter. Josh went from convincing his customers that $100 a bottle was as necessary as air to tracking down bargains around the world. He's the co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and one of our more irreverent regulars. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Hi.
Josh, the most confusing wine labels in the world have to be German. But I understand there's been some changes. Can you explain them?
Yes, they were confusing before, and now they're more confusing now. That's it. We can stop the program. You know, the Germans, they're a compulsive people, and they make good cars, and they do lots of things in a pointillistically perfect way. But when it comes to labeling wines, They've screwed the pooch. They just have, there's too much information on a German label, and all the attempts and all of the buzz and all of the noise about trying to make German labels simple in the process has rendered them in many ways more complex. They just kind of shift the problem from one side of the label to the other, but it's still daunting and confusing for most people to look at, read, and pronounce a German wine.
Yeah, exactly, but also just to know what you're getting. I mean, to have some vague idea of what in heaven's name this wine is and where does it stand sort of on the quality scale.
Kind of makes you nostalgic for Blue Nun when it was simple, right?
Yeah. And May
One wine fits all. Yeah. Sommeliers were out of business. It was the wine that went with everything. And you didn't even have to, you know, say, you know, Liebfrog milk or some variation on the theme. But there's a raft of producers who are renegades in the world of German winemaking, because German winemaking is very traditional and they are rule crazed over there. But these guys have gone beyond the rules and the traditional classifications and even the more modern trying to be simple, mm-hmm. but not being simple classifications. And they've simply labeled their wines any way that they want to label them in the service of making them seem attractive and friendly to people.
So and, who are they?
Well, Carl Lingenfelder is a revolutionary in this this world of German wine labeling. And he's come up with something called simply the Bird Label. And it's a Riesling, and he loves it. But he claimed to me that this is the dawning of post-Chardonism. I love that expression. It's over. It's done. Put down your Macon Village and stop worrying about German wines. Just say Bird Label. You know you're going to get a great bottle of Riesling. It's $15, and he's absolutely right. And it happens to have a beautiful label on it with a bird. And he's picked this proprietary image, and I think that's the path that German wines will be heading in the future. Proprietary names or very simple directions for people so they can understand in one or two snaps what the wine is all about.
Mm-hmm.
But the Deinhardt people have gone one step further. They know that Mosel wines have been required to be put in green bottles. So they came up with the brilliant idea of, let's take a look at our Mosel, our entry-level wine from Berncastle. And what we're going to do is call it the Green Label, Deinhardt Green. That's all. That's all you need to know. It's green and it's good. And it happens to come from Berncastle, and at $9, you should drink as much as possible. And they've had great success with it.
So you're going to tell me the next one's going to be the Blue Label, right?
Well, I think they have a Blue Label.
Oh, okay.
They have a yellow label and an orange label, and each one means something. And it's a sort of a shorthand for figuring out where the wine comes from and ultimately what it's going to taste like. But my favorite for all of these new wave producers is from Louis Guntram. And this guy makes a raft of wines from dry to sweet. And he loves ice wine. He specializes in some ways in wines on the sweeter side of the continuum of German wines.
Mm-hmm.
And he has an ice wine which he simply labels the Penguin. It's perfect. The Penguin. There's a Penguin on there. You know it's going to be cold. And of course, the grapes were freezing when ice wine's picked. That's what ice wine is. It's made from partially frozen grapes.
Right.
One snapshot, and you got the whole thing. You don't have to know anything about German wine labels. You know you're going to get a lovely sweet wine from him. That's about $40 for a half bottle, but, you know, it comes with an eyedropper, so it'll really go around and feed a lot of people.
And somebody else is going to come up with an ice cube. I can just see
exactly.
Now. Competitor. This is great. Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Josh Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and co-author of the classic Red Wine with Fish. Now, you can find his renegade German wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers at Organic Valley. Every week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish. This week, it's no-cook Santa Fe summer pot with avocado and shrimp. We also send along some technique and shopping tips. Best of all, the newsletter is free. So sign up at that place where we solve all of life's little problems, splendidtable.org. Coming up, global curry, the backstory, Japan's trickiest noodle, and the watermelon queen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show where life comes to the table. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like black beans, chorizo, and salsa. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. If I say Indian food, I'll bet the first thing that comes to mind is curry. India's curry is like the pizza of Italy. It's traveled around the world from Trinidad to Japan, from South Africa to Malaysia. But curry's travels came about for very different reasons than Italy's pizza. Curry's story is about indentured servitude, empire, and fascination with one of the world's most complex cultures, India. All of this is in Madhur Jaffrey's book, From Curries to Kebabs, Recipes from the Indian Spice Trail. Madhur is an Indian food expert and a film and stage actress. In fact, she is appearing right now on Broadway in Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical Bombay Dreams. Madhur, it's good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be here.
You know, it's not often we get a chance to talk to an actress while she's actually working on Broadway.
Yeah, actresses don't always work. I've sort of managed a twin career for a good 40 years, so I'm quite happy with that.
Well, I must say I am, too, because this way I keep you in my kitchen. You know, Madhur, you focus on curries in this book, and I kind of have always assumed I knew what a curry was, but why don't you define it for me?
Well, a curry, the British defined it because they needed to define everything when they came to India. They loved the food, and they were defining our architecture, our music. They were trying to define everything, and they had to define the food. So their definition of curry is something to be eaten with the bland rice or bread that is part of the meal, mm-hmm. something that would spice it up. And they refer to it as a dish of meat or vegetables or fruit with a kind of spicy sauce.
Now, curry began in India.
It began definitely in India and developed in India over time with spices that came from Egypt, from Sri Lanka, from different parts of the world around India. But what happened was that when the British came, well, first of all, they fell in love with curry, and they spread it outward.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Indians themselves, who didn't like to travel and very much stayed within India, were forced out because the British had plantations all over the world. And when slavery was abolished around 1834, they needed somebody else to work these sugar and rubber plantations. And I have a very interesting story out of Guyana, for example, where Gladstone's father, he was the Prime Minister of Britain, his father was a big slave owner and had a big plantations in Guyana. And he wrote a letter to somebody in Calcutta and said, you've been an English firm at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're supplying all these laborers to different parts of the world. Can I have some, even though I'm in Guyana? And this firm wrote back and said, of course we can. Mm-hmm. But once we put these people on the boat, they won't know how far they have to go and how long it'll take. We'll just load them and you'll have them, not to worry. And these poor people sang these very sad, plaintive songs, and they were allowed very little on the boat. So they practically lost knowledge of their food, but they had a distant memory of their food. And as soon as they landed with their meager rations, whether they were landing in South African plantations or Mauritius plantations there or rubber plantations in Malaysia mm-hmm. or Trinidad or Guyana, they thought, try to remind themselves of their food and try to recreate it. But the food was always glorious. That the taste they remembered was wonderful. And with whatever ingredients they had, they made wonderful food. And sometimes it was affected by Mediterranean herbs, like in Trinidad. But it was still glorious. It was still a curry. It was a goat curry, but it had oregano and thyme in it also. So, you know, there are marvelous things that happen to Indian food. And I love to eat, but I'm also very interested in why we eat what we eat and why this thing changes from place to place.
You said something in the book that really stopped me in my tracks. You said that Indians believed that if they went on an ocean voyage, they lost caste.
That's right. That's right. Indians of high caste did not travel because they believed that once you crossed what they call Kala Pani, which is the black waters, you lost caste. And anything outside the shores of India, you'd be losing caste. So first of all, the British were very smart. They brought over only lower class people who would not worry about losing caste. Mm-hmm. And this was not mm-hmm. a problem. But it also became very interesting to me because I remember reading accounts of Maharajas, for example, royalty, Indian royalty traveling to England during the 19th century, you know, going to Astor, going to the races, going to Monaco in the early 20th century. And they would propitiate the water. In other words, they would throw diamonds and pearls, etc., and take priests with them who would pray and throw things into the water to pray to the water to not let them lose caste.
So does this mean that essentially India never reached out to colonize in other parts of the world or to trade in other parts of the world?
No. The only people who did go out of India in early, there were traders who went very early on as far as Vietnam, and therefore you see an Indian influence in Vietnam and Thailand and mm-hmm, Indonesia. Mm-hmm. They did go as traders, and though they were lower class people, but they were not the top Brahmins. They weren't going out anywhere.
Well, now let's talk about what are the basic techniques to make a curry?
Well, if you're making a very simple curry, I would say that there's three holy trinities, you might call them. The holy trinity is onion, garlic, and ginger is one. That's the wet trinity, I call it. And then there's coriander, cumin, turmeric, and perhaps chili powder would be another. So you need to brown, and each stage you need to brown the wet spices nicely in oil. Then you add the dry spices and grind them very nicely again in the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the heart of the curry sauce. Of course, there are variations. You can put 100 other things before and after. But if you can get this sauce right, and then you could add a little tomato or a little yogurt as you're browning a little at a time. So now you have your base. And into this base, you throw in your meat or your vegetable. Now, this is curry simplified to the nth degree.
Uh-huh.
You can put coconut milk, you can put souring agents, but this would be a basic curry.
Such a simple idea coming from such a complex history. Madhur, thank you.
Thank you.
Indian food authority and actress Madhur Jaffrey is author of From Curries to Kebabs, Recipes from the Indian Spice Trail. To illustrate how curry traveled, Madhur left us with a recipe from Kenya. Cilantro chicken. You're going to love this. It's simple and so suave. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Brimson is a concert pianist turned cookbook author and food journalist. Her beat is the world, and I love the way she digs for information beyond the recipe or the restaurant menu. She writes for Travel and Leisure. Her latest book is The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Anya, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Anya, I understand in Japan that there are practically temples to the soba noodle, but not other noodles. Now, why soba?
Well, you know, there are other noodles, and then there's soba. Soba, of course, is made with buckwheat. And it's a really ancient dish. In fact, it began in the monasteries. And the Japanese monks were making a ton of money selling soba to the pilgrims. And, well, there are two kinds of soba in Japan. There's a mass-produced fast-food soba, which is incredibly popular. You get, you know, in sutanto, you know, the instant soba at all these, like, vending machines. You get it at Subway. And that's, you know, cheap, good soba that is made with a high percentage of wheat flour that is added to the buckwheat flour. Because buckwheat flour is very hard to work with because buckwheat doesn't have gluten.
So, right, yeah, yeah.
It is very difficult to knead and very difficult to make into noodles. So to make fancy high-end soba is an incredibly specialized skill that takes years. So usually, you know, mass-produced soba will contain a large percentage of wheat flour. And, you know, that's a regular tasty soba. And then there's a teuchi or kiko uchi, you know, the artisanal soba that contains sometimes up to 100% of buckwheat flour. And it is made, you know, by special soba masters. And when you taste it, you really see see what the fuss is all about, because there's, it's almost, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but there's something zen-like in it. You know, the nutty, earthy taste of the buckwheat on your tongue, and the kind of, you know, the handmade texture of the noodles, and, you know, usually it's served in beautiful bowls, you know, rough-hewn kind of, you know, handmade bowls, and, you know, very special broth. And, you know, eating it as a whole ritual. You know, where cheaper places will flourish it with all kinds of, you know, fancy garnishes. You know, usually purists will have a zaru soba, which is chilled soba, served on a bamboo tray with, you know, just a tsuyu dipping sauce. You know, very
simple. What is that?
Tsuyu is a dipping sauce made of dashi, which is a bonito stock, mirin, sweet wine, and shuyu, you know, good soy sauce. Mm-hmm. And you kind of, you know, grab your strand of soba, you know, you dip it in the sauce. And then after you've eaten your soba, you get a bowl of soba cooking water, which is called sobayo, to sip after your noodles, you know, to kind of cleanse the palate. So it's a whole ritualistic thing that the Japanese are so big on. And in Tokyo, it's very interesting. You get some very traditional soba temples. You know, that's expensive stuff, you know, considering this is just noodle. And then nowadays, you get very trendy, kind of designery looking places with, you know, kind of earth art design, full of, you know, terribly hip people. And they still serve this kind of artisanal, you know, beautifully made, you know, homemade soba. So, you know, it's a great kind of combination of the old and the new.
So, Anya, how would we prepare it at home? What's the easiest way?
When you get soba with a high percentage of buckwheat, you bring a pot of water to a boil, you add the soba, and then you add a little bit of cold water to stop, you know, the vigorous boiling, which will break down the noodles. Then you bring the water back to a boil, and then you add a little bit more cold water. You know, just don't let it boil too vigorously. And you boil it for about 6 minutes, you drain it, and then you serve it with a sauce, the tsuyu dipping sauce, which is made of dashi or broth, mirin, and shuyu soy sauce.
Now, you're boiling it, you have it in the pot a total of 6 minutes with the adding
6 to 7 minutes. I mean, taste it like as you would with pasta until it's just a slightly al dente. But, you know, make sure with a high, you know, with good soba, don't boil it too vigorously. If you get regular soba with a high percentage of wheat, that doesn't matter. You can just make it as you would regular pasta.
You know,
you serve it with toasted julienne seaweed, some scallions, and that lovely dipping sauce.
Okay. Hey, Anya, thank you.
My pleasure.
Anya von Brimsen is author of The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. You can get Anya's recipe for chilled soba noodles with dipping sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Tis the time of year for food festivals, fairs, and carnivals, all with their own take on the pageant. True American royalty is being born across the country as we speak. Writer Julie Hauserman has a report from Florida.
The Watermelon Queen stood on the stage at the high school auditorium. She was teary-eyed, but not too worried because she had applied waterproof eyeliner and mascara before the pageant. I'd like to thank the ADC Fertilizer Company, because without fertilizers, watermelons could not grow. And I'd also like to thank the ancient sea creatures that died to make the petrochemicals that made the fertilizer possible, which of course made it possible for me to be the Watermelon Queen. It was a fitting speech for a girl who had really stood out in the talent competition. Her dance was way better than the other ones. They'd all practiced Britney Spears songs on their karaoke machines at home. They showed up in midriff tops and spandex pants. The local TV weatherman was MC, and when he was introduced, some in the crowd actually booed. Farmers don't have much use for TV weathermen. "I don't know much," she told the crowd, "but I know this much is true. I'm ready for some watermelon." Well, thank God. That's one thing we won't run out of anytime soon. We're in Florida, which is the nation's second biggest watermelon producer, just behind Texas. Our agriculture department will be happy to tell you that watermelons are low-fat, good for you, and cheap. They are so good that people break out in celebration. Long about June in the South, the watermelon festivals start popping up. There's the Luling Watermelon Thump in Luling, Texas. the Florida Panhandle Watermelon Festival in Chipley, the Watermelon Wingding in Huntsville, Alabama. Over the summer, the festivals gradually move northward into Georgia, the Carolinas, Arkansas, and the last one is usually at Green River, Utah in the fall. The festivals have seed spitting contests, parades, melon runs, and, of course, watermelon queens. We had a watermelon queen contest in college, a guy friend tells me, but it didn't have anything to do with fruit, if you know what I mean. I ignored him. Watermelons aren't fruits, I said. They're vegetables related to cucumbers, pumpkins, and squash. In the Middle East, people eat their melons with salty feta cheese. Around here, we just sprinkle on a little table salt. But some are inspired to do more. So watermelon season always brings a bunch of melon recipes. There's watermelon champagne, where you puree watermelon with sugar, fill a glass half full with it, and then add champagne. There's watermelon butter, which you make by grinding melon rind on a horseradish grater, boiling the mess with some sugar, and then adding lemon or wintergreen. Occasionally, these recipes get out of hand, like this one from the Watermelon Promotion Board. It's a bizarre watermelon sandwich recipe. That's right, I said watermelon sandwich. It pairs the melon with pesto, cheddar cheese, tomato, bacon, and lettuce. As we say down here, and as the watermelon queen would say if she could speak freely, thank you, no.
All you people look at me like I'm a little girl. Well, did you ever think it'd be okay for me to step into this world? Always saying, little girl, don't step into the club. Well, I'm just trying to find out why, 'cause dancing's what I love.
In the spirit of fair and accurate reporting, I must say Julie Hauserman was never crowned Watermelon Queen. She's a writer in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. You just munched down on a super hot chili. The pain is spreading to your ears. How do you stop the burn? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/supertarget. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question had this setup. You've just munched down on a super hot chili. How do you stop the burn? Sip cream. Pour a packet of sugar on your tongue or suck a lemon or lime. But whatever you do, do not drink water. It doesn't help. Now, the burn comes from a substance called capsaicin. It develops inside the chili. The good news is it's soluble in fat, and that's why sipping cream or other fat cuts the burn. Sugar helps, and so does acid. A little anatomy lesson helps understanding how to save yourself from the burn. Capsaicin starts out on the chili's inner membranes. Now, as the chili's handled, it spread to the seeds and the fruit's flesh. But this is why recipes tell you to cut chili's heat by seeding and deveining. The bad news is that sneaky capsaicin sticks to your skin, and soap doesn't wash it off. you need to scrub with lemon or vinegar or coat your skin with oil before you start working with the chilies. Now, I say don't even go there. Just slip some plastic bags over your hands when you're going to cut up chilies. And when you head out for pad thai or some Texas red, forget the beer in the cooler. Pack the heavy cream. The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, let's get right to the phones. We have got Joe on the line from Seattle. Hey, Joe, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm curious about these little bars of stainless steel that look like a bar of soap that you use to remove odors from your hands. And I'm wondering, well, if the stainless steel affects the garlic or onion residues that are on your fingers, what effect does stainless steel have on the taste of the foods you prepare in stainless steel?
That's a good question. Those bars, by the way, I was asked this a while ago, and I've been curious about them because someone sent me one, and it seems to work, which is the weird thing. And then I went and tried to find some information about it, and what I discovered is there hasn't been a lot of research done. But supposedly, you know, stainless steel is a combination of metals. Mm-hmm. And supposedly, some of those components seem to draw in or seem to neutralize the sulfur that exists in things like garlic and onion. That's the only speculation I've come across. Now, it's a good question as to what does that do when you cook? Because, you know, stainless steel is this highly favored lining for pots because it's inert. You know, supposedly it really doesn't react with anything. It won't discolor. It won't give off flavor.
Right.
But, you know, you've raised a really good question, and I don't know the answer. It could be that it mutes or it tends to neutralize very slightly the flavors of garlic and onion. But as soon as you heat them, they change anyway.
Oh, I hadn't considered that.
Yeah, I mean, think about this. If you take a slice of raw onion and eat it, or raw garlic and eat it, and then saute each one of another raw slice in a little bit of oil,
sure,
in a stainless steel pot, the heat alone is going to change the structure and the flavor. It reacts on the compounds in those vegetables and makes them taste different. So we're never going to know what's affecting what at this point. It's too complicated. You know, Joe, both of us will ponder. And if you get lonely late at night and you're thinking about it, just give us a call and we can talk.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Hey, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, you know, these are the questions that, you know, you have to search for these answers, guys. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We have Andrew on the line from Hillsboro, North Carolina. Hey, Andrew, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, I love your show.
Hey, thank you.
We had an oversupply of cherries and wanted to know what to do with those, and then at the same time now we're getting an oversupply of apples, and we don't use any spray or anything, so that they're blemished, we'll say, and have little wormholes, so I have to cut things out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been making apple crisp every two or three nights, and I was wondering if you
that
had
gets old after a while, right?
Well, not too old, but my wife says so. I kind of keep liking it, but
uh-huh.
And also, what can you do with cherries? We tried freezing them. I was thinking maybe a sourdough cherry bread, but I chickened out on that. I was afraid of that, so I just made a straight sourdough.
Yeah, well, you know one thing you can do with cherries?
Nope.
And it's really easy. It's a takeoff on something from Edna Lewis, the fabulous Southern cook. Wash the cherries. You can leave the pit in, even.
Yeah.
Okay? And take out any of the beasts. And just pack them in sugar in a jar and put them in the fridge and forget about them for about 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
And what happens is you get this, the sugar breaks down the cherry a bit, but and depending on how ripe the cherry is, it might actually get mushy.
Yeah, they were very ripe.
Yeah, so it may turn into like this incredibly, like a cherry sugar. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that whatever fruit is a little underripe absorbs that fruit, and you just put that over ice cream or over cake or eat it on its own from a bowl, spitting out the pits as you go, and it is fabulous.
Oh, that's great.
It's this funny conversion that sugar has when you let it really, you know, draw out the juices of something. And then in turn, the sugar gets absorbed into the fruit. and it intensifies the flavor of the fruit. Now, of course, whenever I think of an overabundance of cherries, I immediately think alcohol. Because there's a great Christmas gift we used to make, which is you go out and buy halfway decent brandy. It doesn't have to be really decent, just halfway decent. And you take the cherries. These would be the prettier ones. And then again, maybe it doesn't have to be the prettier ones. And the idea is that you throw a little bit of sugar in the bottom of an attractive, you know, jar, glass jar. You throw in a vanilla bean that you split. This is only, by the way, if you want to get fancy. And then you throw in the cherries and you cover them with alcohol and you put them in a dark closet. And by the holidays, they are incredible. And you can drop those babies into drinks. You know, you can put them in punch, or you can just, you know, eat them on sweets.
Could you use straight ethanol, or do you have to use brandy?
I think, I don't know, straight ethanol, I think brandy would be a little better. I don't know. You know what? I have to confess something, Andrew. When I think ethanol, I think something that goes into my car. I mean, is ethanol alcohol?
Yeah, 95% is drinkable. But
when you get beyond that, you're into...
Yeah, because there's, I think there's benzene that gets leached in from the distillation process or something.
Oh, we don't want that.
No.
You know what? Quite seriously, I know people use distilled alcohol to make things like this. And, you know, all the better to throw in spices or vanilla or whatever and the cherries. Yeah, I think you really could use it. Okay. Absolutely. So, that's think alcohol, think preserving and sugar. There's always jams.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. And it's wonderful being blessed with all that fruit.
Yeah. Take care.
You too. Goodbye. Bye. You can get to us, guys. 800-537-5252. We have Nathaniel on the phone from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Nathaniel, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question about butter. I'm a big fan of using it for toast and other things.
Right.
And I keep it in a butter boat outside in the cupboard, not in the fridge.
Uh-huh.
And my 80-year-old grandmother does that. I grew up doing it with my parents and all. But I came out here for college, and all my friends look at me funny, and even cooks and older people say, well, isn't that going to spoil? Isn't it going to go bad? And I'm just wondering, what can I tell them in response? Because I say, no, it doesn't go bad. I mean, I've used it for years that way, but...
Uh-huh. Well, there's two schools of thought about this, Nathaniel. And by the way, the noise you may hear in the background, we are not being attacked. They're taking a building down next door. But there's two schools of thought. One is the butter goes rancid, especially if it's unsalted butter. Salt helps preserve butter. So if you leave butter out, you're shortening its shelf life. But you're leaving it out because you want it at spreading temperature. Right?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Now, if you talk to the butter board, they say you should seal the butter because butter, it's like a sponge. It absorbs flavors like crazy and odors. And you should keep it refrigerated. But if you're going to be using up that butter in a relatively short period of time, like a couple of days, and it doesn't taste bad or smell bad, then why not? And the other thing is you can buy these things now. They're called, I think they're called something like butter bells. They're terracotta. And it's like a bowl, and then there's a lid that goes over the bowl. But when you lift the lid, you see attached to the lid is something that looks like an oversized egg cup.
Huh.
And you can put a half a stick of soft butter in that, and you put cold water in the bowl, you see. And then when you immerse the butter won't come out of that little egg cup. It's now upside down, but it's in cold water, which helps keep it a little bit cool and helps protect it from our odors. And you're supposed to change the water every couple of days.
Sure, but I can still spread it in my toast.
Yeah, exactly. So your butter essentially has a shorter shelf life than, let's say, my butter in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Except I have to wait for it to be the right temperature to spread it on my toast, and you don't.
Right. And if I use it, I use it up in a week or so, so it's not, I've never experienced a problem there.
Well, then, you know, you're fine. You're fine. You know, you're using it pretty quickly, and if it smells off or it tastes off, then just don't eat it.
Great.
Okay. Hey, Nathaniel, thank you.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next now? We've got Nina. Hey, Nina, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I kind of collect unusual seeds, and I planted some citrones, thinking that I would be able to do something with them. Well, they're not at all like I thought they would be. And, even though I haven't harvested any, I don't know what to do with them. All my cookbooks just tell me about candying them.
Now, you're talking about, describe to me what it looks like, because this looks like a lemon on steroids, right?
Yeah, it looks like a little watermelon, but pale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you cut into that baby, because it's a member of the citrus family, and if you cut into that baby, you're going to see, the reason why you always hear about candied rind is that if it is, oh, for argument's sake, 3 inches in diameter, mm-hmm. I'd say that there's an inch thick of rind and then a little meat, you know, flesh in the center of the citron. And now the thing is, this is one of the most used fruits in the Mediterranean. It goes back to pre-biblical times. And every time you turn around when you read historic texts, people are doing things with citron. And a lot of times they're candied. I mean, the candying is great, by the way, because you're going to have fresh citron. And it is, it's, and when you candy that, it is going to be like nothing we can get in the store. I mean, it really, it has almost a licorice-y overtone to it. But a couple of things you can do, because if you cut into this, you're going to see it has a perfumey smell with a hint of cinnamon. It's really neat. I mean, it's not a typical lemon. And one thing you can do is you can shave very thin slices, you know, rind, flesh, and all. And you can put them over whole fish, you know, like scales, mm-hmm. and then slow roast the fish in the oven.
Sounds great.
And it's just wonderful because you get that permeation of that flavor into the flesh. They're also, I mean, it's the same technique that maybe when you throw a few of those thin slices into a saute pan when you're doing, you know, pork chops, or if you're cooking any kind of seafood or freshwater fish, lamb and citron is fabulous. Now, the juice, and there's not a lot, but the juice is really precious stuff. And I would say if you have some, you know, great shrimp or something that you want to leave very simple, but at the last moment sprinkle it with just the citron juice, you know, it's going to take a crane to or a press to press the juice out. But that citron juice has that spicy flavor. And then, of course, what people do with it, and sometimes they just thin slice it, leaving the flesh intact, is they do candy it. And the trick to candying things like this is that you really cover them with sugar. You know, you'd have lots and lots and lots of slices in a glass bowl, cover it with sugar, leave it overnight, and the sugar will leach out these juices. You'll drain off the juices, boil them down, you know, like until they're a syrup, put them back over the citron with a bit more sugar. And you do that like 3 nights in a row. So you keep, you're using more sugar. The sugar is permeating the citron. And then the very last thing you do is actually cook it in that syrup. And then you can it in a sterile jar.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of work, but do know, I mean, this is the kind of thing Lucretia Borgia ate. This is the sort of thing that Cleopatra ate. I mean,
wow.
It's really cool stuff.
I'm surprised that I haven't been able to find any recipes or anything about this, even on the internet.
Have you been looking in Mediterranean books, you know?
No, but I should.
Yeah, because it's mainly a Mediterranean fruit. And I know you'll find things in Sicilian books and in Greece and all over the Middle East and North Africa. I'm trying to think. You know who may have some stuff? Paula Wolfert.
Mm-hmm.
Claudia Roden, they both write a lot about the Mediterranean. There's also, Aglaia Kremezi. I know it's a terrible name to remember. It's K-R-E, I think, M-E-Z-I. She writes about Greek food, and she might be a good source, too. So, see, I mean, I think you'll find some stuff.
Well, you've gotten me more excited now. I was kind of disappointed that they were so nondescript.
Hey,
and that I couldn't find anything about them. I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to make fruitcake forever.
No. And just think, it's you and Cleopatra. I mean, yeah, this is heavy-duty stuff.
Queen of the Nile, yes.
You got it. Get that headpiece going, woman.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay,
take
bye-bye.
Care. Goodbye. Citron are fabulous, and they smell like nothing on earth. Oh, they smell like spices. Ah, you can call us, guys. 800-537-5252. You know, we've all fantasized about having a different job. Like, boy, would I love to be a chef or an architect or a cheesemaker. Well, one man set out to make our fantasies a reality without having to resign from where we're working. Brian Kurth is founder and president of Vocation Vacations, and he's on the phone. Brian, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Lynn.
So how does this work?
Well, it's really quite simple. A vocationer is able to take a look at our different packages, and specific to the world of food and wine and beer, we have packages that include baker and chocolatier, cheesemaker and brewmaster and winemaker, and the list goes on. And basically, we set you up into your dream job for 2 to 3 days while on an otherwise traditional vacation. We have a set of mentors, people who are experts in the field, and share that passion, and are going to instruct you on your dream job. And you don't have to tell the boss. You don't even have to you don't have to leave your job.
So let's say, for instance, I decide I want to try out being a chocolatier. How do those 2 days play out?
Well, it's, you know, when I've witnessed vocationers in the chocolatier experience, the very first thing that comes to my mind is the Lucy and Ethel scene, and there's truth in that. But in reality, the packages, in the case of a couple of them, you are actually spending one day being a baker. You're doing pastries and cakes and the like, and then the other day being a chocolatier. And you are doing everything from truffles to, you know, exquisite mini chocolates to, you know, you are dipping, you're blending, you're doing the whole thing.
Do you get a sense of the business end of these
absolutely.
Businesses?
Absolutely. They're going to tell you the ins and the outs.
So how many people have taken vacations?
So far, we just opened our doors, announced the business in January. We started booking people in March. We've had 15 vocationers, and we have just an enormous amount of bookings through the rest of the year. We are doing incredibly well. It has struck a chord with America.
Has anybody just kind of upped and quit their jobs and gone into the vocation?
Not yet, and we really don't want to encourage people to really do that, because taking a vacation is really the baby step. It's that first step to really, you know, open up those windows and open up those doors and start thinking about, you know, what will it take to get out of that office or that cubicle? And that first step.
Well, Brian, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Brian Kurth is founder and president of Vocation Vacations. For more information, you can go to our website, splendidtable.org. Well, guys, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Henry James. He said, "Summer afternoon, the two most beautiful words in the English language." Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's designed to make your work night meals a little bit easier. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Nick Kariakis with help this week from Scott Liebers. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.